good evening, ladies and gentlemen. A very warm welcome to Warwick Arts Centre. It is my real pleasure and my privilege to be able to introduce to you a very prestigious guest this evening. We have with us Professor Jonathan Bate, a scholar in Shakespeare, and who, as you've probably already read in the literature, actually worked with Julie Taymor on The Tempest. So over the next half an hour or so, it's a fantastic opportunity to raise any questions you may have and to perhaps share your ideas on the film, your views on the film. Okay, so I'll make a start. So how did you actually get involved with the film project?
Yeah, I first got involved with Julie Taymor's work when she was making her earlier Shakespeare film, Titus. It was a chance encounter in a way. There was a South Bank documentary being made, actually about Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet film, and I was interviewed for that sort of from the Shakespearean point of view. And I happened to be on a visiting fellowship in Los Angeles at the time at the Huntington Library, which is a great Shakespeare library. And that same day, they'd been interviewing Julie Taymor as she was in LA in the final stages of filming Titus. And she had worked with my Arden Shakespeare edition of the play. And when she heard that I was in LA, she invited me over to see a rough cut of Titus and to talk to her about the final edit of it. And then I helped her a bit with some of the promotion around that film when it came out, and wrote the introduction to the published screenplay. Titus Andronicus, as I'm sure you know, is one of Shakespeare's less well-known, less admired plays. So it was quite a bold move of hers to make a film of it. But I think it truly was one of the great Shakespeare films. Anthony Hopkins plays Titus and is absolutely superb in it. Julie Taymor actually sent a copy of the film to Francis Ford Coppola, who said that he considered it the best Shakespeare film ever made, with the exception of Orson Welles' Chimes at Midnight, which was quite some praise. And I think the film developed something of a cult following. So Julie had quite something to live up to in taking on a second Shakespeare film. And the origin of the film was actually a conversation she had with Helen Mirren, where Helen Mirren was complaining, as many older Shakespearean actors do, of the paucity of substantial roles in Shakespeare for older women. There is, of course, a reason for that, which is that Shakespeare wrote for an all-male acting company. The female parts were taken by the teenage apprentice boy actors. So on the whole, it was easier for them to play younger female parts. And so there are not a huge number of older women's, mature women's parts in Shakespeare. And so Helen Mirren and Julie Taymor got talking about the possibilities of cross-gender casting. And she was very keen to work with Helen Mirren, and so she said, okay, so one of the older Shakespearean roles not written for a woman that you would like to play. And she said, I'd love to play Prospero in The Tempest. So then a decision had to be made as to whether to play it cross-dressed, which is what Vanessa Redgrave did at the Globe Theatre in London a few years ago. She played Prospero, but Prospero as a man. And you know, you can do that. Fiona Shaw has played King Richard II at the National Theatre. But they decided that within the medium of film, that kind of cross-dressed casting wouldn't really work. I mean, everybody knows that Helen Mirren is a woman. So the idea of having her dressed as a male Prospero wouldn't work. So then they talked about the possibility of making some small changes to the script to allow Helen Mirren to become Prospera. And it was at that point that Julie called me up and asked me about whether it would be possible to sort of tweak the backstory of the play, to imagine a situation in which we have the Duchess of Milan rather than the Duke. And the idea really sort of took off from there. A screenwriter was brought in to write some new lines in the backstory. And my view when I was asked about that was that there's absolutely no reason why you shouldn't do that. There's a long history of Shakespeare in the theatre as well as in film of making alterations to the original script to fit in with the dramatic conventions of the period in which the play or the film is being made. In fact, The Tempest is a very good example of that. In the restoration period of the late 17th century, when the theatres reopened after they were the closed during the English Civil War. That was when actresses were introduced for the first time. Instead of the boy actors playing the female parts, you got actresses. And one of the things that happened to several of Shakespeare's plays at that time, including The Tempest, was that additional parts were written for actresses in order to showcase the skills of the greatest actresses of the day in Shakespearean roles. Julie Taymor was very pleased when I sort of told her that. She sort of liked the idea that although she was making free with the original, she was in a long tradition of doing so. So that was how my involvement with the film began. There was then, as so often happens in the world of Hollywood, a long period of hiatus where there was a big question mark over whether the film would be made. Because of funding questions, it's very difficult to get funding for that sort of movie. And indeed, even after it was shot, there was some doubt about whether it would ever actually reach its final edit and be distributed, because it was made by Miramax just before Disney took over Miramax and sort of closed down the Miramax operation. So it was one of the last films that they took over. And I think partly because of that quite checkered history in the distribution, it wasn't promoted and sort of contextualised as well as it might have been when it came out in the States back at the end of last year. And it got pretty poor reviews from the American critics, which slightly surprised me, because it seemed to me that in terms of the clarity of the film's telling of the story and its use of an extraordinary variety of both theatrical and filmic effects, it's a very, very powerful film indeed. The other thing it's just worth saying about the origins of the film is that, as in the case of Titus, it is actually a Shakespeare play that Julie Taymor had directed on stage. It was quite some time before making the movie. She's worked quite a lot with a very interesting theatre company in New York called Theatre for a New Audience, and Tempest is one of the Shakespeare plays that she directed for them. And a number of the effects in the movie actually were taken from the original stage play. I mean, I think the opening of the movie is absolutely fantastic, where, you know, among the most famous lines in The Tempest are the lines from Prospero near the end, where he talks about the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, everything dissolving. So you in that opening shot, you have what looks like a gorgeous palace with its towers. And then as the camera pulls back, you see it's actually a sandcastle on the hand of Miranda. And then as the storm comes, it dissolves. Now, that effect was actually how Julie Taymor began her stage production in New York nearly 20 years ago, with literally the actress playing Miranda with a damp sandcastle on her hand. And in the stage version, the sort of the spirits, Ariel and the fellow spirits, they just wore black, so they were almost invisible apart from their hands. They just came on with watering cans in order to dissolve the sand. And this, something that I think is very characteristic of Julie Taymor's art is that she's very interested in very, very simple, quasi-magical stage effects. She's worked a lot with puppets. She's interested in Eastern theatre and so on. But at the other extreme, she's capable of using extremely sophisticated digital technology in her editing. And the shoot, which they did on Hawaii — I didn't go on the shoot, I hasten to say, unfortunately for me — but the shoot was actually pretty quick. It was a three-week shoot, but the editing process was very slow. One other just interesting sort of detail in relation to the question of the sort of the combination of sort of technology and practicality in the making of the film was the role of Ariel. Julie had seen Ben Whishaw play Hamlet for Trevor Nunn at the Old Vic. He was a very, very young and very striking Hamlet. She wanted to cast him as Ariel, but because he was in another stage play, he was unavailable to go for shoot in Hawaii. So Julie was given this choice: do I find a second choice Ariel, or do I find a way of using the Ariel that I want, but not actually having him on the shoot? And it then occurred to her that actually Ariel is a spirit. For much of the play, he's invisible. He's visible to some characters, invisible to others. Does he necessarily need to be there? Could not the magic of modern film technology be used to sort of transport Ariel to the location? So the great bulk of Ben Whishaw's scenes were filmed with him alone against a green screen, and then he was edited into the picture. However, for the crucial scene at the climax of the movie, where Ariel teaches Prospero to be human. You remember, all the enemies are imprisoned, and Ariel comes in saying how he's moved by this. He's been moved to tears, and if he were human, he would release them. And Prospero says, "Canst thou, which art a spirit, art but a spirit, art but air, do you have a feeling of their sorrow?" And then she says, "The rarer virtue is in forgiveness than in vengeance." And she makes the decision to release her enemies, renounce her magic. For that very intimate encounter, they actually filmed that subsequently in studio back in Britain after the shoot. If you remember the scene, it was shot in a very tight close-up of the two of them, so you didn't really see what the background was. That caught rather well the sort of paradox of Ariel, that on the one hand, he is this sort of airy spirit who is not human, who's transforming himself into a harpy, a flying creature, a voice, a water nymph, all the things that the digital technology can transform me into. But then at certain key moments, it's as if he is human, and that's a very, very humane moment. And Julie felt, I think quite rightly, that had to be filmed with the two of them sharing the same space.
Are there any questions that you'd like to raise at this point?
It's a fairly broad question, but I was just wondering what you thought the film's key strengths were as somebody who saw it from its germination through to its conclusion.
For me, the key strengths come from the performances. I think the clarity and the intelligence of the verse speaking is there right across the cast. I mean, obviously, Helen Mirren is a very, very experienced Shakespearean actor, as are some of the other older players, Tom Conti, who plays that crucial role of Gonzalo, the good old counsellor. And so Ben Whishaw, I think, is one of the finest young classical actors around. So the absolute clarity of the delivery of the verse, which just makes the story completely comprehensible, the characters convincing in their relationships. Then I think the second thing that it catches really, really well is the kind of range and variety of character and relationship. You know, all Shakespeare's plays have sort of different groups of characters. I think, Midsummer Night's Dream, you have the court characters, you have the fairies, you have the rude mechanicals. Shakespeare likes that. And you have the lovers. They're both sort of four groupings. And in a way, The Tempest, a magical play like Midsummer Night's Dream, it's Shakespeare at the end of his career revisiting some of the fascination with the analogies between the art of theatre and the art of magic. And in a way, there are similar groupings here. You have courtiers, lovers, spirits, and then you also have the lower class characters. And I think the way that those different groupings were characterized, again, was very, very strong from the point of view of the narrative. That I think extends even to the relatively minor roles. Some of the minor roles were from the original Shakespearean script were cut out. The group of courtiers in the original is larger. There are a couple of other characters together with Alonso, the evil ones, Antonio, Sebastian, Gonzalo, Adrian and Francesco, they're called, they're dropped out. But I think one of the effects of that sort of streamlining in the edit is that it means that you get a really strong focus on the characterization of everybody in the cast. So for me, I mean, a couple of the roles that really stood out that I think until sort of seeing this evolve, I'd not really grasped the importance and the strength of the characterization would be the two S's, Sebastian and Stefano. That's to say, if you think of the evil characters, on the whole, I think when we read and study the play, our emphasis is very much on Antonio. That's the younger brother of Prospero, / Prospera, who has usurped the dukedom. And the whole of Prospero's plot is to do with bringing his brother to the moment where he encounters him. But his sidekick, Sebastian, who's played by Alan Cumming, who's an actor Julie Taymor likes very much indeed. She's worked with him on stage in New York, and she cast him as the villainous Emperor Saturninus in her Titus film. I think Alan Cumming really, really made a lot of a role that on paper, as it were, doesn't seem that rewarding. And then equally, the other one, the role of Stefano, the drunken butler. I mean, Alfred Molina is a superbly versatile actor. And again, that's a role that doesn't immediately seem that central or that rewarding. But I think the way the kind of trio worked with Russell Brand and Jimon Hounsou and Alfred Molina, you really got a sense of this idea of how the native inhabitant of the island, through alcohol and fear of the unknown, finds himself worshipping this drunken butler. And you suddenly think, well, actually, in a way, this must be simply replicating what happened when Prospero came to the island and took control of Caliban. And that creates a very, very interesting sort of symmetry. And I thought watching the film again tonight, you know, it's funny with a thoughtfully made film, every time you see it, you kind of see things you've not seen before. And I've seen this a lot of times now. But I've even seen it almost in slow motion because I recorded a voiceover for the commentary for the DVD that will be coming out quite soon. And something really simple that I just hadn't really twigged before was the way that the bundle of sticks that Ferdinand is made to carry when Prospero is sort of making him do tasks in order to win Miranda, they're exactly the same sticks that Caliban has just sort of thrown down as he's rebelled. So again, just in the edit there was a very simple edit from the Caliban going off saying he's found freedom, found a new master. The edit then goes to Ferdinand. So I think the art of the editing, the juxtaposition of the scenes really helps you to see the structure of the play. And then I think the other thing that to me is kind of really interesting about it is some of the experimentation particularly through the way that Ariel's sort of acting out of Prospero's magic is performed, because obviously this can only be done with a whole sort of combination of editing skills and CGI technology. So this is a film that's really using the absolute sort of the cutting edge of film technology in order to achieve its effects. And to me, that's interesting in relation to The Tempest, because The Tempest is a play where Shakespeare was using the cutting edge of theatre technology. That's to say, The Tempest is one of a small group of plays written at the end of Shakespeare's career, just after his acting company had for the first time acquired an indoor theatre. So The Tempest is written for an indoor theatre, whereas most of his plays are written for an outdoor theatre. And of course, the moment you've got an indoor theatre, you can control your lighting, you have a roof, which means you can use flying, you have a much better control of your soundscape because you don't have the kind of ambient noise you get in an outdoor theatre. I mean, if you go to the Reconstructed Globe today, you know, there is always a problem with outside noise. And there's all sorts of ways in which a variety of the forms of magic in the original script, the feast that's conjured up, the harpy, the spirits that appear and disappear, the acting out of the mask, the strange unearthly music. In a sense, what Shakespeare was doing, he was sort of saying, I've got a play box here, I've got some new theatre technology, let me play with it, let me create a kind of magic in the theatre. And I think Julie Taymor, who, as I say, is a director very interested in magic, you know, she has a sort of similar kind of attitude of playing with the technology. She's not the first, it needs to be said, who's done that with the Tempest. I mean, I had an interesting discussion with her about previous film versions of the play, and there's a long history of them. There's a wonderful old silent movie version of Tempest from about 1910, one of the earliest Shakespeare films, which has a wonderful sort of artificial little ship, and it's a play that I think since the origins of cinema, it's one of Shakespeare's plays that has fascinated directors who have strong visual imagination. There was the Jarman film, and then of course there was Peter Greenaway's Prospero's Books, which was kind of hit and miss, but although Julie denied it to me, I think was an influence on certain aspects of the film. The moment where her sort of version of the mask that Prospero puts on, the mask for the wedding, where it went into those kind of zodiacal, I don't know how you pronounce it, the zodiac signs, that I thought was rather influenced by the kind of work that Peter Greenaway did, improvising around the idea of Prospero's Books. And then, of course, the closing credit sequence, playing on the drowning of the books again, I thought was quite Greenaway-esque. I think it was very, very beautiful, that closing sequence, actually. I think the way the staff shatters and you see that it's a glass, and then the glass becomes the books as they drown. Often in Julie Taymor's work with Shakespeare, what she'll do is she'll look to find visual, cinematic equivalents for the verbal imagery, the metaphors within Shakespeare. And again, I think that's a strength of the film. The obvious counter question is what I think its weaknesses are. And I'm still very, I don't know what you all think, but I'm still very much in two minds about Caliban. It's very difficult doing Caliban because there's so much history now and so much sort of discussion by critics about Caliban in relation to questions of empire, colonialization, racism, and so on. The idea of the play as a sort of allegory of imperialism, Caliban as the oppressed native. I mean, you know, do you take that line on the play or do you not? Julie said that she wasn't trying to do that, that the reason she cast Juman Hunsu was partly, well, she admired him very much as an actor. She was interested in the fact that he comes from Benin in Africa, and talking to him, he was talking about how where he comes from, people still believe in magic. Magic is real, spirits are real. Witch doctors, tribal elders have a kind of a power and a reality analogous to that of Prospero in the play. And that was what she wanted to sort of bring out with him. My problem, I think, inevitably, sort of looking at it, you know, the sort of, as it were, white English actors filming in a place like Hawaii, which has a history of imperial settlement, and a black African actor playing Caliban, it seems to me to be just sort of inevitably buying into that reading of the play as an allegory of imperialism, which I think is a reading that isn't actually what the play is essentially about. I thought Russell Brand was terribly good as well, I should say. And he was very hard, apparently he was very hard working on the shoot, but he wasn't out partying all the time. He was back in his room learning his lines and was the first on set every morning and generally apparently behaved very well.
The truth comes out, the real Russell Brand. Thank you ever so much. You have another question?
I'm really interested. You said that the choice to turn Prospero into Prospera was, and what you mentioned, that sort of coming out of Helen Mirren and going, you know, what about us?
Yeah.
I just wondered, working on the script and the way that everything's come out, casting Helen Mirren, which is such an incredible actress, what you thought the implications of this were?
Yeah. The main thing I thought it did was, and certainly this was Julie's view of it, was that it does soften the parental relationship. For me, one of the good things that comes out of it is it takes you away from a rather sort of negative Freudian reading of Prospero that a lot of academic readings of the play, and indeed some stage productions I've seen, that those have. That's to say, you know, there's a lot of talk from Prospero about, you know, don't you touch my daughter till you're properly married, and you know, I'm going to make you work for her. And sometimes that's read as, well, the sort of extreme version is to read it almost as a kind of incestuous possessiveness that the father has towards the daughter. But certainly the idea of the sort of patriarchal control over his daughter, that, I think, when you've got a mother and a daughter, that changes. And the combination of feeling protective, but also ultimately ready to let the daughter go, provided the man has proved himself. That kind of maternal tenderness, those feelings of tenderness are there in the script, and having changing the part to a woman does bring them out. When Julie Taymor was saying to me, can I really get away with this? The other thing that I said was quite interesting and sort of helps the transformation is that the idea of magic has, of course, often been as often, perhaps more often associated with women than with men, that's to say with witches, which of course is something Shakespeare was very interested in. One of the things that academics have noted about Prospero is that there are all sorts of respects in which the things that the character of Prospero does are rather similar to the things that Sycorax, the mother of Caliban, has done. And although Prospero always sort of says, you know, I do white magic, Sycorax did black magic, in fact, they do some of the same things in terms of sort of taking control of the spirits, taking control of the island, indeed taking control of the elements. Interestingly, the speech where Prospero renounces the magic, ye elves of hills and lakes and standing graves and books, this idea, I've had the power to conjure up the forces of nature, but now I'm letting them go. That speech is one of Shakespeare's very direct quotations. It's actually quoted from the book where he kind of learned his classical mythology, Ovid's Metamorphoses, where it's spoken by the witch Medea. So the sense that, in some sense, Prospero is kind of rewritten out of Medea, a female witch in classical mythology, and has a resemblance to Sycorax, the female witch who is Caliban's mother, that's a dimension that is sort of perhaps slightly brought out by changing the gender. One of the things that's lost is that sense you get in the first act of the play of Prospero as a rather sort of tetchy schoolmaster. You know, there's those sort of three expository sequences in the opening scene where first Miranda, then Ariel, then Caliban are sort of told the backstory. And the way that it's told, Prospero does, I'd say, seem like a rather disgruntled schoolmaster. And that is an aspect of his character which you don't see quite so much the way that Helen Mirren plays it. In terms of the sort of power politics of the period, I don't actually think it's a particular difference or problem having a duchess rather than a duke. I mean, after all, Shakespeare, first half of his career, Queen Elizabeth was on the throne. And I actually thought the moment towards the end, when Prospero is going to be reassuming the dukedom, and one of the last things she asks Ariel to do is to sort of dress her, to make her ready to become Duchess again, and you just got that little shot of Ariel tightening the corset, and Prospero, instead of having the sort of, as it were, the loose robes of the magician, wears the tight robes of the monarch. I mean, that seemed to me to be borrowed from or alluding to the bit at the end of the Queen Elizabeth film, the Cate Blanchett film, where, do you remember when she has to become queen, and there's that sense that, you know, she's dressed in this extraordinarily controlling, restrictive robe. And so the idea of, you know, the woman having to take on the part of the monarch.
What relation does The Tempest bear to the tragedies and the comedies? I mean, do you see it as a problem play as such?
Yeah, I mean, the conventional answer to that question is that it's this little group of plays Shakespeare writes at the end of his career, Cymbeline, Pericles, The Tempest, the Winter's Tale, where he's somehow gone beyond both tragedy and comedy, and he's interested in family reconciliation, in magic, in strange adventures, people being lost and found. The genre is sometimes called romance. It's a kind of ancient genre. It goes back to the sort of prose romances of ancient Greece. So the idea of voyages, shipwrecks, families that are lost being reunited. I mean, in fact, he's done that sort of stuff in his early comedies as well. Plays like Comedy of Errors and Twelfth Night have had that sort of shipwreck magical romance element. The technical answer, in the sense that it was Shakespeare's acting company who saw his plays into print and divided them into comedies, tragedies and histories, and The Tempest technically is a comedy. It stands at the head of the comedies in the first folio of Shakespeare's collected works. The traditional definition in the period, if you look at definitions of tragedy and comedy in the period, a tragedy is, I was reading a definition today in a dictionary from the period, a tragedy is a history of death, a comedy is a history of mirth, says somebody in a dictionary published the same year as Shakespeare's first folio. Tragedy is a plays that end with death, comedies traditionally end with marriage. In that sense, it's a comedy, it ends with the marriage of Ferdinand and Miranda, and there's very strong kind of comic elements, particularly in the subplot with Caliban, Trinculo and Stephano. But of course, all Shakespeare's plays at some level are hybrids. There's always elements of tragedy in the comedy and comedy in the tragedies. So although nobody's killed in this play, you know, there are moments of bitterness and sorrow. And as so often at the end of a Shakespeare comedy, there isn't a kind of complete reconciliation. You know, the ideal of comedy should be somehow everybody gets married, everybody's reconciled, everybody lives happily ever after. But Shakespeare knows life's not like that. So he usually leaves a few loose ends. I mentioned Twelfth Night a moment ago, and you remember at the end of Twelfth Night, Malvolio is very much left out of the party. And so it is striking how at the end of The Tempest, what ought to be the sort of climax of the reconciliation between the two brothers, Prospero, and the brother Antonio, who's taken the dukedom, it sort of happens, but it doesn't. Prospero says, you know, whom to call brother should not pass my lips. And Antonio doesn't actually apologise. Antonio doesn't sort of, you know, kind of get down on his knees and say, forgive me. The way that Alonso, the king of Naples, who they've been involved in the conspiracy with, he does. He is the embodiment of penitence. But the fact that Antonio doesn't repent means it's not an absolute comedy.
You said in your introduction that the American critics didn't perceive it very well. Mm. What position were they taking in their criticism?
Most of the American critics seem to take the view that it was boring and that it was too close to the original Shakespearean script, apart from the fact that the gender of Prospero was changed. They didn't, I mean, I think what Julia was expecting was a sort of chorus of criticism from Shakespearean purists saying, how dare you make Prospero into a woman? And on the whole, that's not been the view. The idea that the play is somehow, you know, fundamentally kind of ruined by having a mother instead of a father. People haven't said that. But a lot of the American reviews, you know, use terms like lackluster, literalistic. Some of the things that I thought were precisely its strength, you know, for me, the clarity of the verse speaking and the storytelling, didn't seem to have to have impressed the American reviewers at all. Some of them felt that there was a kind of overindulgence in some of the special effects, that maybe there was a sort of disjunction between the special effects and the sort of human narrative. But generally, you sort of got a sense of critics just not being very interested in it. And some of the criticism was appeared to be directed at the Tempest as much as it was at Julie Taymor. You know, so this is one of Shakespeare's less exciting, less dramatic plays. I mean, I think also, I mean, the thing about American critics is, you know, once one or two of the influential critics sort of express an early view, they all tend to follow like sheep. And there's a big kind of season of Julie Taymor kicking going on in America because her other project at the moment is this Spider-Man musical on Broadway, which the critics have really enjoyed slating that. So it's perhaps one of these cyclical things that somebody, you know, who's done work that's been very much admired. I mean, her Lion King musical, you know, was extraordinarily well received, and I think people, it's time to deliver a kicking to Julie Taymor. I didn't really sort of pick up on the British reviews when it came out, but my sense was, I was just saying this to Sarah as I came in, that I think because it didn't do well in the States, and also I'd say because of this, the change in distributor with Disney taking it over, is that when it was released over here, they didn't really work to promote it. Compared with the Titus came out, when I was asked to do a big feature on it in the Sunday Times, and there were lots of interviews with Anthony Hopkins and so on, and there was, you know, quite a lot of noise around the film. You know, noise in the film world is only ever created by, you know, producers hiring marketing and publicity people to create noise. In this instance, I think Disney just sort of didn't bother. They just kind of slipped the film out pretty quietly on a fairly limited release in art houses, yes, such as the Warwick Arts
Absolutely,
Centre.
Absolutely, of course. Yeah.
Right at
the
back.
Thank you.
The
location looks idyllic. How easy was it to choose the location?
Yeah, I mean, the location was one of the Hawaiian islands with this very distinctive sort of dark sand, which did mean that one or two textual alterations had to be made. Ariel couldn't sing his song, Come Unto These Yellow Sands, because the sands weren't yellow, so it became Come Unto These Darkened Sands. It was important in terms of Julie Taymor's feeling about wanting to use location rather and not to film in studio, that she wanted it to be on an island. I mean, that was her starting point. She felt a play you know, uniquely for Shakespeare, because usually Shakespeare's plays dart around lots of different locations, uniquely this is a play that obeys the so-called classical unities of time and place. It all takes place within one day in one place on this island. And I think Julie wanted to sort of capture and sort of make that real. The very beginning of The Tempest has one of Shakespeare's most realistic stage direction, enter mariners wet. I think she felt, you know, to make the film effective, she'd want some real ocean there, so people would really, really get wet, and, you know, some real sand to work with. So once an island was chosen, it was then a case of finding an island that had the right kind of look. She didn't want anything that looked too sort of idyllic tropical palm trees. You know, I'm sure some of the Hawaiian islands were rejected for that reason. And I suppose also from the point of view of persuading her quite high-profile actors to spend 3 weeks on an island. You know, she didn't want it to be kind of too much of a kind of real desert island, so to speak. And she was a very serious-minded director, and she was interested in the history of Hawaii and the way that it was an island that has been colonised by America to the cost of some of the native inhabitants. And in some senses, she thought some of that dynamic of the play was there in sort of implicit in location.
I've got a question. If Judy Taymor was to approach you and she said, I took a bit of a risk last time with The Tempest, well, what Shakespeare play do you recommend that we adapt for the screen next?
I was asked that question by the Artistic Director of Theatre for a New Audience in New York. They had a gala to honour Julie Taymor's work last year, and I went over and sort of did a little speech for her, and they're raising funds for a new kind of purpose-built theatre for their work in Brooklyn, and they want to invite Julie to direct a Shakespeare play to open it when they get the funding to build it. And he said to me, which Shakespeare play should I ask Julie to direct next? And my immediate answer was A Midsummer Night's Dream. It seems to me, in terms of the way in which her imagination works, her fascination with magic, and as I say, with this kind of analogy between magic and the art of making theatre, that Dream is the obvious play for her. And Dream is a play that hasn't been successfully filmed for quite a long time. I mean, there was the old Max Reinhardt film, Jimmy Cagney's Puck, back in 1935, which I think still stands up rather well. But the last couple of movie attempts at Midsummer Night's Dream, the Adrian Noble one based on his RSC production, and that really terrible one by Michael Hoffman, was he called, which had Michelle Pfeiffer, and that's a film to forget. It had absolutely no magic, whereas I think she could do Dream. I fear, though, that the fact that this film hasn't done all that well means she may struggle to get funding for another Shakespeare film. The way she managed to fund Titus, quite interestingly, was that there's a producer that she had worked with who was very friendly with the sister of a man called Paul Allen. Paul Allen was the co-founder of Microsoft and is one of the sort of half dozen richest men in the world, and is devoted to his sister to such an extent that he bought her a first folio, you know, which cost him a few million. And she does a lot of work with the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. And Julie Taymor's producer managed to persuade her to put up the money for Titus, like a sort of act of patronage of the sort you used to get in Shakespeare's time. But that sort of thing is pretty rare, and I think the current state of the movie industry, it's hard to imagine how she would get funding for a kind of high tech, quite big budget film of the sort that The Tempest was. It has been a little while now since there was a really commercially successful Shakespeare film. I mean, we would have to look back to the Lerman, Romeo and Juliet. The next one that's coming is the Ralph Fiennes Coriolanus, which he directed as well as acted in, and I don't think that one is going to be a huge box office hit. So, but Dream is the film I'd like to see her.
Well, thank you so much. Okay. If you'd like to join me in thanking.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.